Hello and welcome along to another RT Rugby podcast. Week 3 of the BKT United Rugby Championship is in the books. Wins for Connacht, Leinster and Munster. Ulster unable to make it a clean sweep for the provinces though, after they were beaten again in South Africa. The first big double Interpro week of the season is ahead of us. Leinster and Munster are close to a sold-out stadium at Croke Park on Saturday evening. That'll be followed by Ulster against Connacht in Belfast at 8 o'clock. We'll also be talking to Hannah O'Connor about Ireland's WXV defeat to Canada a bit later in the show. So if that's what you want to hear, the timestamp will be in the episode description below. You can jump straight ahead to that. First, though, Bernard Jackman and Johnny Murphy are with me. And Johnny, you had a good second win of the season down in Shannon at the weekend, 23-18, a real dog one out in bad weather down in Limerick, and two wins out of the first three games. You've a little break this weekend, but a solid start to the season all round.
It's been a decent enough start. We've a couple of new lads come in, a couple of kind of local guys that were playing in kind of Division 1A have come back. It's a good start. It was great to get a win in Shannon. I think in conditions like that gives us a bit of momentum going into kind of what is our, I suppose, historical or kind of local derby against Wesley Saturday week. So yeah, fairly happy with the start, but the league is mental. So, you know, you could have a great start and end up being like Balvo last year. I think they went in sixth or seventh into the last weekend and they end up getting to the playoff final. So every point matters. So but it was good. Nice to get last weekend.
Yeah, well-earned break this week. And Bernard, you were down in Cork braving the conditions. Top work, I would have to say, by the people running, the production staff around last Saturday's broadcast on RT, I would say. The four of you crammed inside in the little commentary section down in Musgrave Park. I would imagine that hadn't been planned out earlier in the week. It was very much response to the conditions. Fair play to them all the same.
No, we were supposed to be pitch side, but I became a diva and said, no way. We even gave Murray Kinsley the option of coming up with us, but he's old school. He wanted to be to be down there in the
wet. He's a pure pro.
In fairness to the crowd, like 2 hours before the game, we were kind of looking at the conditions going, because we were there for the Leinster game, and we were going, like, if you bought a ticket to this, would you come? You know what I mean? Like, and in fairness, they came and they got involved, and Munster gave them lots to shout about as well. It was actually a decent atmosphere. Big game for Munster, a lot of pressure on them, and they responded incredibly well. I think they'll all be feeling a lot better about themselves this week than would last week. Would have been a tough week.
Yeah, I wasn't down in Cork for it. I was watching it on TV though, and I have to say, you pointed out the crowd. I was actually struck by how the terraces didn't look like they'd been kind of filtered out a little bit. There didn't appear to be too many no-shows, which was remarkable given the conditions. And I'd say anyone on Munster Rugby, they need to be considering trying to find some way of not refunding, but offering a little something extra to anyone who has a ticket stub from the game last weekend. They certainly deserve it. We might start with kind of the Leinster-Munster build-up, so I suppose, and we can work in Munster's win against the Ospreys off the back of that. But just like in general, Johnny, as of yesterday lunchtime, Leinster confirmed we're now up at 75,000 tickets sold for the weekend. They're confident that they'll be pushing up towards above 80,000 by the time Saturday evening rolls around, which is going to be comfortably a new URC record for a standalone game. This rivalry's taken a bit of a bashing down the years, particularly when Leinster were kind of very dominant in it in the late 2010s and kind of early 2020s. But the last 2-3 seasons, it's now starting to look as healthy as it's ever been, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%. And I think being URC champions 2 years ago, I think kind of, cemented that rivalry back to where it was with Munster winning that. And I just like to get that many people, you know, it really shows the appetite for what this fixture is and what it is historically. And no doubt, like, they're going to get that. It's going to be a sellout, you would imagine, given there's still a few days to go. It's brilliant to see. And like, you know, Birch has played in them, I've played in them. And I've played in some brilliant rivalries over in England, but I've said it loads of times before. The first one in the Aviva, only 3 or 4 games back from England in 2010, it was insane. Like, it's one of the most, and it's back to those to the hype of that as it was, and kind of, and it's brilliant to see. It's great for the, it's great for everything. It's great for rugby in Ireland, and I think it's, hopefully it's a great advert for it. But yeah, it's brilliant to see, and I'm really looking forward to it.
Just on that, Johnny, I was chatting to a Kiwi friend of mine, a guy called Blair Stewart, who I coached in Grenoble, who's now back in Auckland. And we were just messaging on WhatsApp this morning, and he said, "Oh, what's going on there?" I said, "Oh, actually, Leinster play Munster in Croke Park. There could be 80,000 people there." And he was there. You guys have it so lucky. I mean, amongst his friends, amongst the New Zealand public, it's where do they go next to kind of get a competition that gives them that rivalry? You know, obviously missing the rivalry with the South African teams. The Aussie teams are obviously in a little bit of disarray, and they're craving for a rivalry or a competition structure that gives them big days. We know, look, it's not every week. There's certain games that don't have more than 10,000 people at it. But in general, I think there's a the club game here is doing a good job of attracting supporters into venues, and hopefully we get a good product as well.
And Bernard, even off like off the back of that, even as well, I do think maybe 10 years ago or so, it felt like the attendances for these big games were taken for granted a little bit, and there probably wasn't as much of a sell put into it. You do get the feeling in the last 2 or 3 seasons though that there has been a way more concerted effort to really, really drive home the importance of these games and drive those numbers up. Like, I know. There's obviously a lot of people are probably going this weekend for the novelty factor of it being Croke Park and it being a big day out and stuff like that. But last season, straight after the World Cup, when I'm sure some people might have felt a little bit jaded by rugby, there were still just under a couple of hundred short of the Aviva Stadium being sold out for Munster and Leinster. Then St. Stephen's Day down in Thomond Park, that was sold out as well. Like the numbers are consistently there. This isn't just a case of it being a novelty game in Croker.
Yeah, 100%. It's there now. And look, I think as Johnny said, Munster win the URC, beat Leinster en route to it 2 years ago, has just given those Munster fans a bit more confidence. Obviously, top of the table last year in the URC. So, and you know, we're seeing guys like Calvin Nash, Jack Crowley, etc., come through and play for Ireland and be able to hold their own. Nankivell is a very, very good operator. Tyburn, as I said before, some of that back, the back row, obviously Cadellan's away, but they still have a huge amount of riches there who will fancy themselves or love the opportunity to go against the Irish back row. You know, I know Pete's out, but it's still very competitive in a lot of areas. But Munster need to find a bit more. I mean, the reason Leinster have so many internationals is that they do. They do seem to have a little bit more quality when it comes to the big games. But Munster only need to be better than Leinster for 80 minutes on Saturday to get a massive win. So it's going to be fascinating how both teams prepare for it, how both teams play, and then obviously tactically, I think particularly Munster how they play because it's really Munster's attack against Leinster defence. I think Leinster attack shown signs of being better, but realistically, the most marked difference between the teams is Leinster's defence with that team that played against Treviso, which you would imagine be very similar, was pretty impressive.
And
Yeah.
Johnny,
On that, Birch, in terms of the prep and stuff, I think you can get a small bit of a clue in terms of conditions and how they played last weekend in Musgrave Park. Like, there's 3 or 4 instances where the referee is speaking to Tadhg Byrne and actually use the words like, "Well, the breakdown's a complete mess," you know. Like, and I think that they're really going to focus on that area to try and get the physicality, lay down those markers. Like, they're after, you know, everyone kind of dogging them out of it about what happened the week before, for them to come and show a physical edge at the breakdown like they did at the weekend, I think was a real statement of intent. And it was for the whole 80 minutes. Like, their second efforts defensively, you know, in attack, everything, they were just, it was unbelievable. Like, I thought, in conditions like that. And I think that gives you an element of where their mindset is going into that, in the lead up to this block, and in particular the game on Saturday night. I think the breakdown is going to be class to watch, because it's going to be, it'll be, to use the referee's word, it's going to be a bit mental.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. On the, we'll get into the games itself then. So Munster 23-0 against the Ospreys, as I said. And we were speaking to Graham Rowntree yesterday, and the win was obviously very important. The bonus point is very important. The nil was massive for Munster as well after what they'd been through the previous weeks as well. But what Rowntree was saying, Birch, was the thing that jumped out for him the most, that he was happiest with, was just the attitude from not even the first whistle to the last whistle, but from Tuesday or Monday or Tuesday morning in training last week, right through, where they knew they'd completely let themselves down in Italy, and there was a clear determination not to let it happen twice in a row. It was very, very impressive from an attitude point of view.
Yeah, and I think that's been the biggest difference for me from the Johan era to a certain extent. Like I think there's always under Rowntree, there's always been more of the old school Munster value on evidence. You know what I mean? They've been hard, they've been combative, they've been proud. There's been days when they just haven't been good enough, you know. And I still have fears about that squad in terms of the overall quality at the top level. But as Dunica said the week before, there's a lot of things that you don't need a huge amount of talent for to do. And I thought Munster got those right again on Saturday night. And to be fair to them, that's why I like the Zebre match was a massive outlier, to be fair, like in terms of that collapse. And under Rowntree, under Prendergast, under Leamy, when Pete and Tighe and Jack Crowley and stuff have played, I think they've been very consistent in terms of being very hard to beat. And they got back to that, and I think the Munster fans, I think even them will realise that this isn't the same generation as the Rodgers, you know, the Paulies, etc. But they still will follow them, you know, once they put in a real honest shift. And yeah, as I said, I think even against Connacht, they were loose and there was defensive errors, etc. You know, it was a better performance than the Zebra one, and now Osprey. So they've had two out of three that have been more than acceptable, but this is a big test. And then they go to South Africa for 2 weeks against, you know, I think it's the Sharks and the Stormers. So they're gonna find out a lot about themselves over the next 3 weeks.
And it was funny, Johnny, like another thing Rowntree said after the match on Saturday was the conditions for what they needed that week and the response after Zebre. The conditions on Saturday actually probably suited them because they knew that weather was coming all week. And if anything, it actually kind of focused the mind and narrowed down the game plan and made the performance so much about attitude and commitment rather than, you know, executing short little passes or getting the ball to width.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think it was obviously from the kickoff straight away, there was an intent and there was a busyness about their you know, about their display that was good from the start. And I think that to hold them out, I think was, as you've said already, like they show that there from the very, very start. And I think that yeah, there was just a basic, like for 40 minutes like the previous week, they just dropped the ball on their basic standards and just completely left them. And that can happen sometimes when you have a bonus point in the bag and different things, but it certainly wasn't there. And to a man, they really rocked up. And I think stuff that doesn't require any talent, like the breakdown and all that kind of stuff, they were on it, you know? Yeah, they were really, really good.
Bernard, in terms of the game plan they had at the weekend, did that show signs of a bit of an evolution with the way they're thinking? Where I was at a handful of games last season in similar enough conditions to that, and the frustration of watching them around midfield trying to run through 20 phases, tipping on the ball to each other and overplaying it in brutal conditions. I'm looking at the Leinster and Connacht games around Christmas and New Year's Day last year, Bayonne at home. Northampton at home. Granted, those two matches, the rain wasn't as bad, but it was in, you know, for maybe a 15-20 minute chunk of the game when there was just clear frustration that they weren't really playing to the conditions. Where on Saturday, they didn't really move the ball around a lot. They used Craig Casey and Jack Crowley to kick the leather off it and kick it really well, chase the ball down well, and just harry Ospreys into making defenses so that they, you know, they tailored their game plan to suit the conditions they were going to play at the weekend.
Yeah, to be honest, they had no choice. I don't think they actually could have actually played. And
But they, but I'm talking about last season. There
yeah,
were
but
a
this was
couple of games
worse.
in similar conditions where they tried to do that.
Yeah, well, maybe okay. Yeah, if they did, I don't doubt you. I'm sure they did, but they would have learned from it then. It was very, very difficult to pass the ball more than two players wide. I do think, look, I think they're maturing. I certainly think halfbacks for sure are maturing, you know. Like, I think Craig Casey's in the form of his life. His kicking game has come on leaps and bounds. He's when he darts now, it's more productive, you know. It's at the right time, whereas I think a couple of years ago he was just doing it regardless of whether it was on or not. Obviously he's physical. Jack is very physical as a 10. The variety of his kicking game was excellent, and they just kept their four pack chasing down Ospreys, you know, kept them the ball in front of their nose. And I'd say they are got smarter. I mean, they definitely have a coaching group who are young, keen to give the players the best. Even, you know, George Murray is highly involved in the kicking side of it as well. The analyst who's been there since the start of pro rugby. And I'd say they do want to evolve. And there was evidence of that on Saturday. I'm fascinated to see if it's a dry night on Saturday evening, if they do play that pragmatic game, you know, because there's a lot of teams who will try and play what they normally play every week against Leinster.
Sorry to interrupt. Do you think they should try stay a bit more pragmatic this week?
Yeah, I do. I think, look, there's definitely opportunities. There's definitely kick space, kick pass space. Yeah. You can get around them as well if you get lots of width and you get the right playmakers on the ball. But it's what you do after that. I mean, I thought Leinster's scramble against Benetton was exceptional. It's better, look at the problem they have, I think, at the moment is with their non-internationals, when they get busted, and it didn't really matter against the Dragons because the Dragons didn't have the quality to hurt them. But the non-internationals' ability to scramble isn't as impressive as obviously the top class athletes. You know, you're like, there's a clip there at the weekend where Zebra or Benetton in the first half bust Leinster near the end of the first half, and they just get into the 22, and you just see Tadhg Furlong and Porter flying around the corner. You know, Benetton would have felt, oh, we can just stay on top of them here, and they get smashed behind the gain line the second phase. I mean, you know, the sub props who came on for Leinster don't have that capacity yet. You know what I mean? They're not athletic enough. The mixed teams that we'll see certain weeks in the URC don't have that athleticism. So that's a challenge. So I would be very, I'm very interested, because I really rate Mike Prendergast. I'm very interested to see, does he say, right, let's do what we do and we're good enough to find holes, or do we say, okay, let's box really clever here. You know, let's not let them get energy by catching us behind the gain line. Let's have a couple of first phase strikes where we know we can predict exactly where they'll be and where we'll be, and we can hurt them. But then what do we do in the next phase? Do we allow them catch us in the middle of the field behind the gain line? And then it's all very hard. So as I said, what was impressive on Saturday was their understanding of how important it is to play on the front foot, whether that's through running or kicking. I thought that was very conditions specific. But again, do you just box clever and tailor your game plan to an opposition who, to be honest, I think to beat them, you need to tailor your game plan. If they play what we expect, I think you need to, because you're not Toulouse, you're not La Rochelle. You know, you don't have that power and ability. Both teams have a lot of ability as well. Both those two teams. So yeah, that's going to be for me the most interesting aspect of the game.
I think it's the Leinster's ability, as you've already said, like to double down off a line break when they get bust. Most defensive systems will probably kind of take it easy there and try and get you to an edge and build their system back in, where Leinster's system is on a bust, they double down and they actually go harder. And once they're onside, even though they're tighter, they'll go forward more and they'll chase their outside shoulders. So it's that's the one where when you get line breaks, you have to be, rather than, and most teams are like, well, we'll play on top, but they bring so much line speed that they end up winning the gain line there. And then after you making 30 or 40 yards, you're all of a sudden within two phases back where you started, but you feel like you're playing. So it's within the system, they have to figure that out, because there are holes there, I think, from like, you know, Ulster showed it last year, you know, and that is the gamble they play in a system like this, is the kick space. So, but it's when you make that line break, it's where you go after that is the really, really important thing, because they have so much power and they have so much pace coming off the defensive line, that if you don't have that, you know, like Coombs is trying the first round where they make a break and then he's straight up the guts of them, and Munster won't get the opportunity to do that against Leinster, because he'll be met with someone flying off the line there and they'll lose momentum. And that's the thing that I think, that's the battle. It's off the line breaks. It's where you go then that makes Leinster so difficult to break down on a whole.
The other challenge for Munster, obviously, at the moment is the injuries are starting to add up yet again. So Peter O'Mahony and Ollie Yeager both out. That's in addition to Thacker Abrahams being out this weekend. Shane Daly and Billy Burns are more unlikely than likely to be available this week. On the positive side, Alex Nankivell, Tom Ahern, Ruan Quinn and Mike Haley should be available, according to Graham Rowntree yesterday. Bernard, I saw you speaking on the 42s podcast about obviously the injury situation and how, you know, this is the third year in a row now where early on in the campaign injuries are starting to pile up, and at a certain point you do have to start wondering what is the cause of this. Is it coincidence, or is there a correlation between things that are happening? I put it yesterday to Graham Rowntree, asking him, have they kind of done a review internally of their training methods, their S&C work, their preparation, their rehab, all that sort, all those sorts of things, their recovery after matches, to at the very least make sure it's nothing of their own making, this injury list. He said there is absolutely no correlation between the injuries on the pitch and what they're doing in training, that they've gone through all the data in the off season. They're able to measure their training to the minute, to the meters players are running, based on all the GPS and stuff like that. They obviously have all that tech as well. Obviously, though, it is a concern to see these bodies starting to pile up on the injury list so early in the season.
Yeah, and look, I've no doubt that they've looked, that the Graham Rowntree's livelihood depends on having his best players available. So I wasn't saying that they wouldn't be reviewing it. Mm. But unfortunately, it's now the amount of injuries and the regularity of those injuries. You just have to make sure that you are checking everything. Like, there's lots of different reasons why players could be getting injured. It's not always about on-pitch load. And the beauty of the Irish system, very similar to the Welsh system, is you actually have benchmarks. You know, so, okay, Leinster are not going to tell Munster what load they have. But when you get someone like Dennis Leamy, who's crossed from one side to the other, they have a very strong idea of it. It's, you know, it's not beyond reason that they wouldn't be able to share their information with the IRFU and the national S&C coaches or national coaches and make sure that they're on track there. So I would say, I actually think now, I don't think, originally I would have felt it was to do with load and on-pitch load, because Munster were very open about how they changed that. And I've been through this in Grenoble and Wales and Dragons, where people did break down when you spiked their load. But generally then they adapt to it, their body adapt to it, and they become more robust. But they still need to always keep an eye on it, because it's like none of the other provinces are having this level of bad luck. And to have it 3 years in a row, I think you may have to look at other areas like recovery, well-being, you know, nutrition, S&C work, travel, whatever it takes. It could be one small underlying factor that's causing some of these injuries. Some of them are going to be just, you know, contact injuries or bad luck. The game, exactly. But just like to have it this early in the season, and for it to happen 3 seasons in a row for that big spike at one stage, or at a stage is difficult for him. It's difficult for the coaches trying to put together a team, you know. So, I'm not surprised they've reviewed it, but unfortunately, it's worrying for them, and it's costing them points. It's costing them points.
Yeah, and one thing he did kind of stress yesterday as well, some of these injuries they have at the moment are quite short term, and you know, while there is a lengthy list there at the moment, as he pointed out, they'd be fairly hopeful Nankivell, Ahern, Quinn, Mike Haley are are available this week. Billy Burns and Shane Daly probably wouldn't be too much further behind. So within a couple of weeks, this should be getting a bit shorter, unless obviously they pick up a few more. Last point on Munster before we get in on Leinster properly. I know we spoke about Leinster's defence a little bit, Johnny, but someone I did want to mention who we've got to see a little bit of now in the, well, plenty of in the last couple of minutes, who we've got to see plenty of in the last couple of games is Brian Fitzgerald, who Munster signed through Gary Owen, 25 years old, been a regular AIL player over the last couple of seasons, and got him in on a short-term contract this season. And through, I suppose, some of those injuries, has managed to see plenty of game time over these last two matches. You would have come across him obviously playing Division 1B rugby in the AIL last year with Gary Owen against your own team, Nace. He's settled in very, very well. He might not play this week if Alex Nankivell is back and stuff like that, but I thought he was worth mentioning because he has looked at home at this level.
Yeah, and look, I think that's I certainly think of within the pathway within Munster, the AIL is a pathway that's not closed off as it is potentially in Leinster, that there is an opportunity to really develop that pathway for Munster. And to be fair to Cozzy and Gar Prendergast, they're really trying to do that. And yeah, Brian was probably, I would say, probably the best player in the league, who was playing week in, week out, even, including all the contracted guys that would have played a number of games. He was the standard bearer for Gary Owen. And obviously that led to promotion. So for me and the AIL, I think it's brilliant to see and someone get the opportunity. And look, he's 25, so it just shows you that there still is opportunity. If you can play consistently, your team is in the mix for a promotion or playoff spot in 1A, then it's great to see. You see the likes of James Humphreys, obviously he's come through the academy, but he's been Banbridge and Queens last year. He's played the last couple of games for Ulster and done well. Look, there's a whole host of guys that are doing it week in, week out at AIL, that if they get an opportunity, there's no doubt. But I think it's great to see from Brian's perspective, because he was, you ask any opposing coach and he'd be the first name that you'd write down in terms of, who was Gary Owen's standard bearer throughout the season last year.
Neil, can I ask Johnny a question? Just sledging's been in the news for the last week and a half with the Sexton book and the Ricky Ioane stuff back and forth. Johnny, as a Leinster man, a mercenary Leinster man playing for Munster, did you anything comes to mind from Munster Leinster games?
There was a couple, all right, but probably being a, I suppose, a plastic Munster man, as I was called actually by my Munster compatriots. I suppose we used to get a lot of stick that we could actually field a Leinster backline for Munster while I was there, between the years between myself, Keats, Conway, Denny Hurley,
Downey, was he there? No.
and Conway, yeah, and we all,
Yeah.
and Copey as well was in that mix, and we actually all lived beside each other, so we had our own kind of clique within. It was like the Irish guys in Leicester. But yeah, my first game back, I remember, first did that one in the Aviva. Damien Varley and Owen Rednan played with each other over in Wasps, and we obviously had a rivalry. But I remember the first breakdown I was involved in, I carried, and Redzer was, I think Luke, I think I was playing, yeah, I think I was on the right wing. I think Shaggy had tackled me anyway, and he was trying to kind of pull and drag at the ball, and Red put his head over the ball, and I could actually just see Varles was coming out to the thing. I could see Varles' face light up. It was the happiest I've still to this day, even on his wedding day, he wasn't as happy as he could see Redzer just over the ball. And he accelerated from about 10 to 15 meters away. And when he hit Redzer, there was this noise. I actually thought Redzer was dead. Like, and it was like 10-pin bowling alley. Like,
Yeah.
just things just went everywhere. And yeah, there was kind of, because and Varles was actually laughing, like the sledging that went up, like it wasn't sledging, it was just laugh. And like, to be fair to Red was like, oh, good one, good one. Like, this is all in the middle of the game. So yeah, stuff like that was, yeah, fun. They're always good games. But yeah, I'll never forget Varles' smile when he saw Reds are over the ball. It was very, very funny.
Bernard,
Yeah.
any you can repeat?
Yeah. Look, it was a massive part of that rivalry. And to be honest, we probably had to. We for a couple of years we said, "Oh, poker face, don't show any emotion." But that was you couldn't keep your mouth shut. Like there was just it was just too it was too intense. But I actually remember, and I actually think it's reverse sledging. So probably 2005, 2006, I was playing for Leinster. I just joined Leinster, and we were getting killed by their forwards in Thomond Park, the old Thomond Park. So. Which some of the listeners will remember. So Terrace is on the side. It was the far side. It was the Shannon side. Anyway, Munster catch a line out on the 22, and they start to maul us up the field. Obviously, as a hooker, I'm in the tram. But after about 15 meters and the crowd going mad, I say, right, I've got to collapse this, right? So I go in and do the old deck chair to try and collapse it. Fail miserably, and next thing, I'm on the ground, and Munster have basically 16 feet just going up and down on my back. I get a shoeing, which I completely deserve, whatever, right? And unfortunately, this is the one time the maul doesn't go forward. So it's actually just, they're just stationary over me. I can't remember who the referee, I think it was Nigel Owens, was delighted to see me getting the treatment I deserved. And it saved him having to give away a penalty. But eventually, anyway, I can just hear O'Connell shouting in the maul, "That's it, lads, he's had enough," whatever, right? And they are. And they all stop, and they move on. Then they go forward, and I just like it was very nice of Paul. But it's in the middle of a game, you actually don't want pity from them. You know what I
Yeah,
mean?
it's a
So
real backhanded.
it's a backhanded, like, yeah, you fucking don't even deserve to be sledged here. So yeah, that was the one I remember. But look, there was loads,
Just
but yeah,
on Bert, there's loads that we can say as well.
no.
Just on the on Birch's one about being like cool and calm, we had Jerry Hursey as our sports psychologist that year. You know, he's done a lot of work with boxing, and he's really good, like brilliant at what he does. And the whole build up was of the end of this block. I think Leinster had lost four in a row or five in a row. It was Joe's first year, so it was like this was going to be, you know, kind of the nail in the coffin. But we wanted to be very calm, collected, and Jerry had this whole thing planned like out all week about how we're not going to get in, you know, we're not going to engage, you know, no off the ball stuff, just do our stuff. First 60 seconds, there's like a 30 man like all in, bullin' and dragging, like Jerry's work for like 2 weeks just straight out the window. First ruck, it was just like, right, everyone in. It was just, and we were all kind of laughing about it, going, well, come on, like Jerry, just poor old Jerry, like his heart was broken after the game.
Best laid plans. On Leinster, we've spoken a lot about Munster so far, so we'll give Leinster their discussion here. 35-5 against Benetton at the weekend. Looking back on the match, Birch, it did seem as if Leinster's team sheet bought them 7 to 14 points early on in that game. Benetton just did not look up for it at the start.
No, they didn't. And Benetton had made a poor start. That was obviously the worst performance, and they've had a lot of discipline issues. But they got completely. It was like they had no belief. They played like a team who didn't actually believe that they had the tools to trouble Leinster. And like the amount of passes that just went to ground, how soft they were in the contact area. It was a very worrying performance for Bort Lamy. He'll take a bit of heart that the second half was a bit better, but yeah, 100%. I think, look, when we all saw that Leinster team, we were like, "Wow, that's a flex." And unfortunately for Bort Lamy, I think his players looked like they actually believed that they couldn't win either, or certainly weren't prepped for what was a physical, accurate performance for Leinster from that first half. To have a bonus point at half time in on a poor pitch, bad conditions, was a very, very pleasant surprise. I think even for Leinster, I think they would expect it to be harder.
Yeah, it was a good like get in, get the job done early, and get out sort of a performance from Leinster, Johnny, wasn't it? Like they didn't, there was that one excellent Kieran Frawley try, where they really kind of flexed their muscles in terms of attack and stuff. But aside from that, they kind of just it was as if they knew what level they had to be at, and if they needed to step it up a gear or two, they probably looked like they were going to be able to do that.
Yeah, I kind of felt that the last three games had been kind of, you know, well, maybe not the first game, but I do feel that there was a level of kind of coasting in it for them, that they're kind of just building and, you know, getting used to kind of Tyler. No, interesting. You know, for Frawley's, I think that kind of shows what they can do and what Tyler's kind of looking to do. They play a four-man shape off nine. They go out the back and then short runners off that. They seem to be kind of clicking in and out of kind of two different systems, be it 2-4-2 or another one. So they're having different kind of attack structures, attack frameworks within games. It's difficult to read, but. Yeah, I think when they got their bonus point, and particularly like Darce's try seems so easy, you know, like it came off a couple of runners around the corner. He gets the ball, and then like you even feel like he's expected to be tackled there, and he just bit a leg drive and over he goes. It was just, yeah, I just feel they've kind of been coasting a bit, and you know, leads up to kind of all roads lead to this weekend, obviously for them. But yeah, it was a fairly solid four. I think their second half was. You know, obviously was pretty average. But yeah, it was kind of game done, and they just kind of plodded through the game and tried not to eke out too many injuries or anything like that, you know.
Bernard, what were the early RG Snyman signs? He got 50 minutes. Obviously, played his part in that lovely Ciarán Frawley try, where he takes the ball up to the line and pulls it back, like we would have seen him done for Munster in South Africa when he was available in the last few years. Got on the ball, a few nice little touches, a couple of offloads here and there as well.
Yeah, he did, but he also didn't look. He looked rusty, and he still had an influence on the game. I actually think he's going to be a bench player for Leinster. I think he could have a situation, or he will have a situation.
Use him in the same way South Africa have kind of left.
Yeah, and I actually think Barrett will be the same. I think if Leinster have everybody fit, they'll have Slimani, Barrett, and Snyman coming off the bench. Slimani, obviously, definitely because Furlong's going to start, but I think it'll be the same for Barrett and Snyman, and I think that's. That's probably why. Obviously, if James Ryan is injured, John McCarthy's injured, he starts. But I think that he's very, very well suited to coming off the bench and changing a game. And when you look at the quality players Leinster have that are Irish qualified, that Farrell will want to be starting those big games. I don't think it'd be anything disastrously wrong for Leinster to have Barrett on the bench as well to come on, you know, to help you win games. So, but yeah, Snyman is going to be a very, very useful weapon. In actual fact, I thought Leinster showed in that first half in particular a real eagerness to offload in situations when, you know, historically they would have just looked for leg drive, get go forward over the last couple of years. So, is that something that Blindale's going to add to it? It will be interesting. It obviously suits Snyman. I mean, that's probably the most exciting part of his game is that unique ability to get his hands free in collisions and put people away. So, but it's look at seeing the team and seeing him in it, was pretty impressive. But I could see a situation where those three foreign players are actually bench players for the big European games and the knockout games in the URC and. It's it's that South African mentality to have the finishers to come on the bomb squad as such. And I think Leinster's challenge now is to find more, to find Irish qualified players who can have the same type of impact.
Johnny, I believe that's called an embarrassment of riches, the prospect of those three sitting on the bench.
Yeah, and I think probably if they do want to go 6-2, having Barrett as that second back, as you kind of with that versatility and what they have with, you know, if Jimmy O'Brien's playing or Jamie's on the pitch, or you know, they can move things around. Yeah, it's a bit insane, really, with those guys coming off the bench if that is the case. So you just look at, and that's there's going to be some serious talent missing out on those squads when they get everyone in and they get everyone fit. Yeah, it'd be interesting to see what they do selection wise this weekend in terms of the bench. Whether I think the 6-2 kind of hurt them, obviously, with having you know Jimmy having to go off earlier, they had to rejig a few things. I think Keenan was you know was playing majority of the game on the wing, which kind of messes up kind of what a bit. So when you're 6-2 and you lose a back early, you're in a spot of bother. So be interesting to see what happens there with that. But yeah, what an embarrassment to Rich to come off the bench.
The one other bit to talk about though, Bernard, around Leinster is one issue that's cropped up 3 games in a row now, and was an issue throughout the last couple of seasons as well. The scrum is still, it seems, wildly inconsistent would be the way I would describe it. 4 scrum penalties against them at the weekend, 2 against Andrew Porter, 1 was against Tadhg Furlong, 1 was against Michael Milne. So it's not even just, you know, one particular player. who's given away these penalties. It was Rabah Slimani gave away a couple in his first two games and also won a couple of big penalties as well. It's not necessarily that it's a bad scrum, but it seems to be wildly inconsistent and very, very dependent on the interpretation of a referee.
Yeah, and that hasn't changed, and that's probably the interesting thing. My understanding is that Joe Schmidt was the Irish coach when Leinster went after Rob McBride, and I think he had reservations just based on what he saw or what Greg Feek saw when they scouted Wales. Obviously, Robin had been with Wales, and if you remember Wales under Robin, they've always been a real messy scrum,
Yeah.
particularly their loose heads, and they never really got tooled up. And they could often win key penalties as well, but it was always very wild, and it depends on interpretations of referees. And it was very hard to dominate them because they would always win one or two penalties, and then sometimes teams just backed off a little bit out of fear. So I think he was worried was that kind of Robin's philosophy. And I suppose we kind of have seen that a little bit in Leinster in that it's become quite individual. And it's different. So like Dan Sheen, he wasn't playing the weekend, but over the last couple of years he's been the starter, or even when Ronan Kelleher plays, obviously back up to Dan for Ireland as well, with Andrew Porter and Tadhg Furlong. They scrummage differently, in my opinion, for Ireland than they do for Leinster. Not massively differently, but
In what way?
there's
In what little ways?
a I think in a they're much more. I look at people would throw back the argument to me, oh, we got blown away against by New Zealand in a quarter final era. But in general, I think they're maybe less aggressive. In general, now obviously that game Porter was very aggressive. But they generally are less aggressive, more compact, more focused on quality of ball delivery and not giving away penalties than they tend to be with Leinster. And now the challenge for Fogarty is to get the same three players into that mindset when they come out of Leinster, So it's probably one of the areas where it's not as aligned as maybe it could be. But having said that, I'm in favour of the provinces being allowed to do things their own way. And look at it, to be honest, if you look back at that Toulouse final, Leinster scrum was dominant. They were dominant against Toulouse, and that wasn't the reason they lost the final, So I think they probably feel, from a Leinster point of view, they probably feel when we have three world-class front rows and a world-class pack, we should be able to win games with our scrum, and we should be able to dominate like that top 14 mentality. Unfortunately, in the URC in particular, there can be vastly different interpretations. And, over the first three games, as you mentioned, I don't have the exact stats to on hand here, but my feeling is that Leinster have been up and down in terms of the penalty count. And it's not the end of the world. Other parts of their game are more than adequate enough to win. But it's just something that they definitely would want to be keeping an eye on, because it will hurt you. If you get on the wrong side of a referee against a team that are evenly balanced against you, that could be the key factor, as we saw in that quarter final for Ireland. It wasn't a huge amount of scrum penalties against Porter, but there were important ones at key times,
No, I've seen all three games so far this season.
Yeah.
I would definitely agree that they've won a lot of penalties, but also given away a lot as well. We do need to obviously talk about the other Interpro this week, Ulster hosting Connacht. And to start with Connacht, because they got their win at the weekend, or on Friday night to start off the weekend, 24-23 away to Scarlets. Fourth in the table with 11 points, a good solid return to three games. But Johnny, their supporters must have aged like milk in the last 3 weeks, because every game seems to be an absolute thriller.
Yeah, they're great to watch from a kind of a neutral perspective. They play a great brand of rugby. Mac Hansen's come back. He's hit the ground running, and they've built a really good squad. Like I think, obviously losing Keane early on Friday night, you're kind of going, oh, what's going on? But Paul Boyle came on, and I thought he was excellent. A couple of really big carries in the middle of the park for Murphy's. He has a really good support line there with Conor Oliver. Yeah, I think they're probably the be disappointed in terms of their management of the game at, when going 14 points up. I think they probably had an opportunity to kick on, and I think that's been their kind of tag in most of their games, that when they're on top, they need to not drop, instead of dropping maybe 40%, just try drop maybe 10, 15%, and not, it's just something that. But yeah, I think they're a great team to watch as a neutral. Every game they're in is good, but they're in a good spot. Like they're going to be going up to Ravenhill, particularly after winning the way they did last weekend. Last couple of minutes and then holding out. They're going to be going up there with a lot of confidence. And it's been a tough couple of weeks for Ulster after a really good win first weekend, but it has been a tough tour to South Africa. For them, altitude, heat, all that. So, but yeah, for me, I love watching Connacht. Love watching how they attack. And there's always a bit of excitement about them.
Bernard, are Connacht favourites this week?
I think they have to be. I think they have to be. Yeah, I think they have to be. Obviously, look at Ulster will say, that win against Glasgow, that's a sign of where they're at. And the tour was a chance to mix and match a little bit, give people opportunities. Ravenhill will be bouncing. It'll be totally. Ulster will be a lot better, but I think Connacht will be really happy with how their game looks. I think their backline strength and depth, or the backline quality they have, is certainly better than Ulster's on paper at the moment. Obviously, we're waiting for Cordero to find his feet, but when he does, they're going to be more dangerous. And yeah, I think Connacht will feel Ione will be back in, I would imagine, from his HIA. There's a bit of momentum there, a bit of belief. And if they're not slight favourites, I think they certainly will feel that it should be.
The issue for Connacht through these first three games, though, Bernard, it seems to be that when they're getting hit, they're getting hit in flurries. So the first game of the season against Munster, they started off really well, but then they allow Munster in for two cheap tries in the space of about 3 minutes of each other to get Munster back into the game. Against the Sharks, obviously, they had that first half where they gave up 27 points in no more than 20 odd minutes. And then against the Scarlets last week, on Friday night, Connacht start really well. They get a nice little lead, and then they get hit with two Gareth Davies tries in a 6 or 7 minute spell as well. There has been a portion in each of these three games where they've just let the standards drop and they've got hit with multiple tries.
Yeah, 100%, and that's probably been an issue with this squad under Andy
Yeah,
Friend as
it's
well.
not a this
And
season issue, true, yeah.
yeah, under Andy Friend as well. The only thing I would say is they found a way to win the last two games. They found a way to come back against the Sharks and to not let that momentum the Scarlets had be detrimental to the result, and found a way to win at the end. So I think they'll be very conscious of that, of both those swings of momentum. But they'll also say, look, last year we would have been beaten out the gates. Like I remember last year against Bordeaux, better team than the Sharks. But like once that momentum swung, it was the end of it, and the Scarlets aren't a great team, but Connacht did manage to, slow down their loss rate and found a way then obviously to engineer that penalty for four at the end and close the game out. So I think they were looking to try and build belief and there'll be two of the things they'll be talking about, saying, look, it's not ideal. We have to stop those wild swings of momentum, but we did manage to get the wins this year, whereas previously we would have lost.
And Johnny, you mentioned Ben Murphy's try a little bit earlier on as well. That's now three starts in a row for him, two or three tries in those three games. He's showing like that performance down in Thomond Park. It wasn't just a once off.
No, he's been really, really impressive. Very controlled. His support lines on line breaks are excellent. And yeah, I he's been. He's had a really, really good start down there, and taken opportunity that he's been given. He's probably, well, on form. Is he number one for them? Definitely there. I think he's worth going up. Obviously, there's a bit of family rivalry there going up and playing up in Ulster, but yeah, like I've been incredibly impressed with him, and yeah, I'm looking forward to see how he develops, particularly within the back line that they have, and how they play can really suit someone with his, in his style. And He has a really good kicking game, so he can mix and match as well. But yeah, I've been really, really impressed with him so far.
And we have seen it down the years with so many players, Bernard, where someone just lands in a team and the situation just fits.
Yeah, and I think this is, I think like it was a really smart selection by them because on what he'd shown for Leinster, you wouldn't, sorry, the layman wouldn't have expected this match to be such a good fit. But they obviously had clarity around how they wanted to play. I thought Blade had to play too much last year and affected his form a little bit. So they needed somebody, but just the right person and the right fit. And Ben, obviously, with Blade having been on the tour of South Africa, Ben got in early, had a brilliant preseason, showed what he was about, blew them away with his athleticism and his fitness, and got that first start, and then took his chance. So full credit to him. He has played in some big games for Leinster off the bench, but to get that start against Munster and to put in the type of performance he had, and to be rewarded with more game time, and again, impressing those. Is credit to him, but I think they were very clear about what they wanted in a scrum half, and he ticks so many boxes. So I think Connacht are getting the reward for that homework they did, and that clarity around what they want and what Ben can bring.
Yeah, well, his dad is going to have to do a bit of planning around him this week ahead of this game on Ulster. I know, like Bernard, last week, like we obviously mentioned that the Bulls hadn't really looked too impressive in their first game, and there was a slight feeling that there could have been something there for Ulster to take. All of that feeling went away for me on Friday morning when I saw the team the Bulls had selected. That was, in terms of loaded, it wasn't far off what Leinster had done against Benetton. Like that was the first team out there as well. Johnny, when you look at their two performances and two results over in South Africa, like it's two defeats. They've got one bonus point out of it, and they're coming home. They're low down on the table. But what positives can if you're the eternally optimistic Ulster fan, what positives are you taking from what they've got down in South Africa in the last 2 weeks?
I think experience for those younger guys, I already kind of name check James Humphreys and a couple of lads like that have gone down, experienced that. Also, Jacob Stockdale, I think his form is starting to kind of move forward. He scores an old school try for him, back to when he was good at the weekend.
That kick over the top we've seen so many times.
Yeah, back to where he was in probably the best form, when he was. Nominated for Six Nations player of the tournament and top try scorer and when his form has been really, really good. And then I suppose you've watching, with the team that the Bulls had, as you said, but when they got that third try, like that was a brilliant try. How they played into that in their multi-phase game. And then you're kind of going, right, okay, here's the chance now to kind of I put another passage together, get another bonus point, and that would have, they'd be with the team that they had and the team that the Wolves had. You'd be kind of going, okay, well, that's something to build on. But I think home comfort again for this weekend, given the last time how Ravenhill was rocking. It's an Inter Pro. I think there is light here in terms of. They've got one, which was a really tough block when you look at the start of the season for them. And be interesting to see now how they perform back at home on a Friday, on a back at home in Ravenhill. But yeah, I think this is a process for Richie. He's going to build. He has to kind of get guys some experience, and then do what he can. And pick up what he can when he can, and I think they've started well enough, and the building blocks are there to be seen from particularly when you look at a couple of their tries on over the weekend.
They have scored over in these two games, Bernard. I think that's probably worth pointing out. I know they've conceded a lot as well over there, but are we talking seven tries across those two games?
Yeah, they have scored, and I think they always will. I think there's enough ability there. Stephen Ferris, the weekend, I think in the Sunday Independent, in his article, he said they have lots of players who can actually win collisions with the ball It's just how many of them are winning and without the ball. And that was obviously evident against the Bulls. Look, I think, as you said, on paper, that was a very experienced, expensive Bulls team. It was always going to be the question mark. But against Connacht now, who in this Ulster team is actually going to start to become, an enforcer defensively and put Connacht back on their heels? So that's not really clear. Obviously, Isichuku and stuff. That's some of the players in with the emerging Ireland. You fancy them to have that ability, but that'll be the next step for Richie is to build a defensive steel that they can actually rely on week in, week out. And it's not easy, but he'll be very aware that that's a challenge.
Yeah, so as I say, that game is 8 o'clock on Saturday evening. There'll be a live blog of that on the RT News app. Leinster and Munster coverage on RT2 and RT Player gets underway on Saturday evening from 5 o'clock as well. Commentary on RT Radio 1, and we'll have a live blog as well on the RT News app. Johnny and Bernard, thanks a million for joining us this week on the podcast. For those interested in WXV rugby, though, Hannah O'Connor is going to be joining me next, and we will chat through Ireland's defeat to Canada on Saturday night and look ahead to the final game of WXV1 against the USA on Friday night. Now, next on this week's RT Rugby podcast, we're going to return our attention back to the WXV. Ireland beaten 21-8 by Canada in Vancouver on Saturday night. So it's one win and one defeat for Scott Beaman's side ahead of their final WXV game against the USA this Friday evening, 8:30 p.m. kickoff Irish time. Hannah O'Connor is back with me for the third week in a row to talk through things. Hannah, good to have you back again. It was always going to be tough to match the highs from 6 days earlier against the Black Ferns, but another very competitive performance and probably a game, even though it finished 21-8, that probably wasn't reflective of the 80 minutes as a whole. It feels like it was one Ireland could have actually left behind them.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thanks for having me on again, Neil. It was definitely, I think, an overwhelming feeling of frustration and disappointment probably from the girls watching that one back. Because as you said, the scoreline probably doesn't reflect the match itself as a competitive fixture. And there was mistakes on both sides, but the girls will definitely feel that that's one that got away from them, definitely.
Yeah. And that was basically exactly what Scott Beaman said himself after the game, that it was a 10-minute block just after the kind of midway point of the first half that the game really just was spun on. Ireland get two yellow cards within the space of 30 seconds.
I
two
know, yeah.
Front rows as well. Their two starting props go off for yellow cards. And by the time the second of those, Niamh O'Dowd is back on the pitch, it's 21-0. And all of a sudden, Ireland are completely chasing the game.
Yeah, it's a momentum killer, isn't it, as well? It's because, like, of the period of the game that it was, like 25 minutes on the clock, you're kind of real settled into that. The girls had a few cracks at it and themselves, really even keels, nil all. Set piece was kind of swaying both ways, nothing really given either side there in terms of dominance. Then it comes to that, and yeah, you're like 24, 25 minutes, bang, bang, two yellows. I think they were harsh. I think from Linda's point of view, she's given it as a knock on, it's gone down as. But like in my eyes, I think, like, looking at it, it's one of those 50-50 ones. She's either offside, Linda, coming through, but the nine has picked it up there at the back of that ruck. So, like, she has it. I thought she had it up in the air. So it was a bit of that one where you're like, is it really? She was a fair stickler on it. And Niamh O'Dowd's one of those maul infringements that she's saying to her, like, was she giving her offside at the maul? I think it was. But it's again, it's one of those calls at the maul wheels, and all of a sudden you're looking at someone's ribs in front of you, and it's the temptation not to be able to hit them. So that was another one that sometimes goes your way. But generally, when a team is rumbling like that at that stage, the referee is never going to look at it too favourably. But yeah, as you said, it was just bang, bang, momentum killer. The game was kind of hinging on a knife edge up until that point. And all of a sudden then you're down two players. And I actually was taking notes. I was like, for 13 minutes of that 10-minute period, obviously the penalty try, as 7-0, they were doing really, really well. And the benefit of having the likes of the Sevens girls and the likes of Emer Constant in the backfield, who are well used to marshalling that backfield of loads of space, they did really well to scramble at times and to defend and do a soft jockey defence at times to get themselves out of trouble. And then literally, I think it was like, whatever, 34 minutes, they only had a minute more to spare before they got one of the yellows back. And all of a sudden, yeah, as you said, it's 21-0, and it's a real zapper because you're 5 minutes before halftime then, and in a half that you haven't done too bad. But all of a sudden, you're looking up at the scoreboard saying, geez, how have we ended up here? So yeah, a bit of a momentum zapper with those two yellows.
Yeah, and I think actually what ended up being a real killer. Now, I know as well for a few minutes of that block, it was 14 on a minute or so of that. It was
Yeah, it was, to be
15
fair.
because Canada had their own yellow, but it was pretty much straight after it was straight after Canada scored their try. The first try when Niamh O'Dowd had been yellow and it was 15 on 13. And one of the Canadian players knocks on from the restart. And I was laughing because you could see she was shaking her head in frustration after knocking on. But all of a sudden, what ends up happening is not only have Ireland now lost Linda Dugan and Niamh O'Dowd, but they have to bring on two props.
It was really a tactical knock-on, wasn't
Well,
it?
like I was laughing because in my head I was thinking it would be a great idea to just get a scrum straight away. It hadn't
Yeah.
occurred to her because she looked really, really annoyed at her. It was like a simple little knock on, but
I know.
all of a sudden you have to bring on two replacement front rows, and you lose Fiona Chute and you lose Emer Considine.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, just the numbers have become even more muddled around the pitch. And ultimately, for the second try, Canada finally got the ball to width, and it was down the vacant Emer Considine wing that they had the extra number and get in for that second try. And
Yeah.
it's funny the way just the game script goes. Had Ireland been able to hold out maybe for another few more minutes without having to have a scrum,
I know
this could
what
have
would have
played out a
happened.
little bit differently.
Yeah, exactly. I remember seeing that happen. I was like, surely now if they can get through, as you said, like get through a big chunk of this without having a scrum or the need to make the extra swaps, they'll be doing okay. And sure enough, of course, you couldn't write it like that. The script went that way. But it's like it throws rubs at the greens, isn't it? That everything they touched last week was on the money, line out on the money, scrum on the money last week. Entries into the 22, excuse me, really good. And then this week, like things like that, double yellows, and things not going to plan. The referee, giving some calls that, even at line out time, the referee, now again, you can't blame the ref, but just the frustration of at times early doors, the girl's ready to go in the line out, and then you're stopped, waited, sometimes a penalty given for numbers or a free kick given for numbers, and just little things like that that kind of stunt your flow a little bit. But yeah, it was, as I said, the fact that the try was scored, down that side of where the vacancy was, they were doing really well, like considering, but like losing one is difficult, but losing two, as you said, like you're always going to have, it's almost you forget yourself when you're on the pitch. You're like, geez, you cover for one and you kind of have the ability to do that in terms of the folding out. But when it's two, there is a lot bigger holes. But yeah, it was a bit of a sickener from that point of view, but kind of regrouped at halftime. And as you said, like bar that 10-minute block, the game is there. Like, and even in that block, when Ireland were down to 14, Aoife Wafer took off at a break, fed Enya, and then there was a period, I think, that led to Canada's yellow card. They were still going at it with 13, like before they even, still being brave enough to play and not sitting back in their own half. So they showed glimpses of what was there. And even in the try that, again, another Wafer carry taking out about four Canadian players, which led to a gorgeous crossfield kick from Dana. The flashes of it were there. And it was still nice to see the girls playing with that to their systems and sticking to their style despite kind of things going against them. So yeah.
Yeah, and like just staying even for another couple of minutes on that kind of 10-minute yellow card period. As you
Yeah.
said, the it wasn't as if Ireland fell apart over the course of 10 minutes, because there was, for probably the first 6, 7 minutes of it, there was plenty of good stuff done. There were a couple of maybe a couple of loose kicks on it. Dana mistouched on
Yeah.
one of the penalties, but the defense was still quite solid for the most part of it. And as you said, Aoife Wafer goes on that run, which forces the Enya Breen gets the ball, which forces the Canada yellow card. Ireland
Yeah.
tag on 3 points, and all of a sudden it's coming up towards the end of that yellow card, the yellow card period, and it's 7 points to
And three,
three. And you're thinking
yeah.
they might have got away with this one, but is a big part of what they would have learned at the weekend just like about compounding errors with errors, where they concede those two tries back to back, and one of them was just, it was a turnover in midfield, and I think you can see Enya Breen is, she thinks they've secured the ruck, so she's gone back to the
Yes.
other side of the pitch, and the gap is there. But even it goes back to there are other stages in the game. Like I think you mentioned one of the 22 entries early on, where the ref was being a bit pernickety. I would say
Yeah, we call
she
that.
had her research done on Ireland's
Yeah.
lineups and things to look out for. So I don't think we can complain too much maybe about her, because
No.
they probably were correct calls, but
They were, yeah, they're
they
just
were
ones that
pernickety.
frustrate you as a line-out caller. Because it is, as you said, it's always that one as a line-out caller. And especially with Ireland's style, you get some refs that want you in. They want you in from the start. And the girls, the system is obviously walk in late and get in and then kind of do it quick. So yeah, she was. Look, she's right. It's the legalities of it, or the laws of the game. But yeah, those little things that hinge on the referee kind of, going with you on them or going against you. But it kind of, those little rubs of the green weren't quite going in the girls' favor. And as you said, like so unusual for Dana to miss kick for touch in that occasion, and just that kind of kick field battle. or yeah, kick the kick battle was just it wasn't quite where it was. And as you said, that turnover, like, which led to their try, that was, you know, the Canadian try. I think it was their second try. It was, you know, one of those things that you just like frustrated with. You know, the ball comes back, Dana decides not to kick it, shifts it to Amy Lee, and she gets swallowed up, and all of a sudden the ruck looks secured for the world, and all of a sudden, for some reason, Canada come out with it. Those things that last week were a bit sharper around, and the girls were so solid on their own rucks, that, you know, New Zealand weren't able to get a sniff of any steals of breakdown last week when there was just a bit of sloppiness with it. But again, look, as you said, the learnings from it, like the overwhelming feeling from the girls, would probably be frustration and disappointed at what could have been, because as you said, for that 70 minutes, they were toe for toe with them and able to put it up to them, bar having to do it with a deficit of two players and two props at that, that completely shuffles the rest of it when the scrum comes. But I suppose they'll learn from that. Like the clinic, like Canada didn't play particularly red hot, but they were clinical. And I suppose the ability of them knowing, being at that kind of top tier a bit longer than Ireland have been kind of meeting with it, that they're clinical. We may not be playing very well here, but we're able to take our chances. We'll be able to make our entries and make them, you know, make them pay, I suppose, for when they do get the chances. So again, it goes back to, I suppose, what we said in terms of the learnings that the girls will take from it and benefit leading up to next year's World Cup, that like it's another opposition that they've played, another top two tiered or seeded country in the world. They would have feel like they had the measure of them. It would have been interesting to see what way it would have went if 15 players were on 15 for the whole pitch, and those little things, those little moments kind of went your way. But again, it's all, as you said, to not compound errors of that nature with another error that gives easy ins and you give teams easy outs for, you know, the ref, you know, talking back to the ref at one stage, which are those killers that she marches you down, especially a ref like that who's going to take no kind of jib from anything. So all of a sudden you've gone from being a kick on your own 10 to being inside your own half, and all of a sudden you're defending them all, and it's like a layered effect. So yeah, the compounding, the kind of the insult to injury, I guess, is a learning for the girls to take away from it, but definitely against caliber teams of that caliber, definitely.
Yeah, and that was the bit, like I'd marked that down. It was a quarter of an hour in. Ireland had they'd been getting some good phases together in the 22. Wasn't long after Dan O'Brien had a good 50-22, and they have a line out just inside or in around the Canada 22. They give away the penalty because Brittany Hogan joins the line out or joins them all a little bit too early. Then about 10 seconds later, from you know, Canada clear the lines from that resulting line out. Ireland give away another penalty. Cliona Maloney gives another 10 meters for back chat, and all of a sudden Ireland are defending a line out on their own 22. I'd say there were 40 seconds between the two of those incidents. So you know that's the kind of compounding one error with another thing. I mean, like to look more on some positives though, I think like in the grand scheme of things, it's something that quite a few people have pointed out in the last couple of days that we kind of do have to step back a little bit and realize we're here really, really surgically picking apart what a 13-point defeat against Canada. If you had told most people 12 months ago that Ireland would be in this situation, we would have thought that that was fairly fanciful thinking.
This is it, though. Like, and as I said, it's great to be at that stage where you feel like that you're like, this was there, and this was there for the
Or
taking for the girls.
where we can really analyze, I suppose, micro details of the performance
Exactly, because
rather
of the
than a whole
nature,
system.
100%, that the system is still there, that there wasn't, as you said, like the defensive, the missed tackles might have been coming during that period where, you know, you're down bodies, and it's just from literally lack of players at times that it, but as you said, like being able to pick those little bits and have a game in front of you that you're able to literally pick it against a caliber of team like Canada, that you're able to analyze the two teams fairly with each other. Like, as you said, a year ago, or even coming up to the end of the Six Nations, there was probably people who said, why on God's name are Ireland in WXB1? Like, they have no place being there. There was a lot that wrote them off and thought that they'd be the whooping boys for that league. So like to have them in there in that tier with the rest of them, and to be one from one with the feeling of what could have been with the second game, it's a great place to be. It stands us in good stead that the performances where it was a loss, there's a lot to be taken from it in terms of learnings from it, but it was definitely a decent performance. Not their best, but again, a lot of good flashes there to be seen to follow on with what they've done already.
I think we kind of said earlier on Canada weren't particularly outstanding, but I think in contrast to New Zealand last week, they definitely had done their homework on some elements of the Irish game. And I think in particular, one of them was where Ireland did really, really well was when they were keeping the ball tight and they were, you know, getting very good gain line success. But when Ireland got the ball wide, Canada were very, very dangerous out there. I counted, I think there were four either jackal penalties or jackal turnovers. when Ireland had got the ball out into those positions, and you could see the Canadians were very, very hungry as soon as that ball went to ground to get in on top of it. And they had obviously seen something that Ireland probably weren't committing as many players out there.
They were, yeah, and it's probably it said it within the Irish system is like they back everybody to do their job, and whether it's a backs ruck or a forwards ruck, that yeah, Canada, as you said, were quick to snaffle up anything, and a few times the girls came unstuck were in those wider channels or in the wider areas where either they were low on bodies or someone was a few times like so uncharacteristically shoveling a pass that probably wasn't on or giving an offload that wasn't on that led to someone being absolutely met on the gain line and smashed back, and all of a sudden then it was a scramble ruck. You're committing bodies then to that ruck. All of a sudden, there's not enough bodies in the next pod to set up your momentum and your flow. So fair play, like Canada, it was like they learned from New Zealand's mistakes in terms of, as you said, those learnings to be taken from it. And they tried their best to marshal, I suppose, Aoife Wafer for a bit better too. There was a lot of bodies around her, and she still caused damage. So all those, you know, all those signs of, again, learnings, as you said, that like you have to be able to do those finer details and take what was good from the week before and layer onto it in the next week. But as I said, a tricky one. It's always hard as well because going into a competition like that, it's the same with if you're going into Six Nations. You know who your opposition is for game one, and you probably get to spend a greater deal of time analysing your opposition to great effect. And all of a sudden, then once you're in it, you've spent so much time analysing the Black Ferns. They have been your kind of food for thought probably for a month, if not more, of the girls' time, and you know, on whiteboards that you know so many days until we play them. And all of a sudden, then you're in the competition, and you've got a week to kind of review and analyze all at one in a real condensed period of time, which the girls are used to, but it is trickier to do. And obviously, as you said, Canada probably did it a little bit better to capitalize on, again, not playing well, but still being cute enough to get out the other side with the victory.
One of the other positives, like obviously it was a big blow to lose your captain Adele McMahon in the couple of days before him at a training ground injury, but after we got a glimpse of her off the bench against New Zealand, where she scored the two tries, Erin King came into the starting team and was absolutely outstanding again. And it wasn't something that I suppose it probably just hadn't occurred to me. I can't remember who was on commentary on the stream for it, but pointed out during the first half that I think she's played, is it six senior games of 15-a-side
Senior,
rugby
yeah,
in her
probably
career,
only about that.
which is just a remarkable statistic to see how well she's fitted into the system.
Yeah, it's been great, like to see her, and I said, unfortunate for Adele that she missed out through the injury. But to see like Erin get, she said, I think she said herself that you know she'd been, you know, plugging away in the background, and you know, great to get her 2 kind of minutes off the bench and kind of teak on a bit more. But yeah, there's nothing quite like starting, and like fair play to her, like she fits in like a glove in there, that she's adapted her mindset from the sevens to 15s. Really, really well. As I said, she hasn't got much experience with the 15s game and the senior level. Like she obviously played a good bit of underage, which a lot of the sevens girls mightn't have in the past, that they might have gone into sevens from a young age. So definitely that stands her in good stead that she's played with her kind of club grown up and had played with Old Belvo for a couple of games a couple of years ago. But an underage with Leinster as well, she would have played for kind of like a really good team that they had, which was the likes of, along with the likes of with Aoife Dalton and Dana and Aoife Wafer. Actually, that team, they all played together in one team and they were under 18 as babies. But yes, great to see her kind of get her first start and to be, you know, well able to pull her weight there and to do a job, you know. And like in things like line out and everything, there's so much to learn there. I think she was saying like in terms of learning how to be part of them all and what's involved in that. So she's learning definitely in at the deep end with the caliber that they're against in terms of team. But no, she's flying it, and it's great to see, as I said, depth coming in that position. The even seeing her like when Ireland were down players and seeing her hands in the loose, like she's well able to pass the ball as well. So her skill set from the sevens transferring over definitely helps her massively.
Yeah, it certainly does. And well, we're watching out for more in the
Yeah.
future. We'll find out obviously on Thursday night who is starting, whether Adele McMahon's fit or whether it's Erin King starting again in the back row. Probably not much we can discuss now in terms of team selection, Hannah, because like for those listening, we're speaking here on late Tuesday afternoon. By the time you're actually listening to this pod, it could be Wednesday afternoon, and the team announcement is going to be later on Wednesday night. So probably not much point dwelling on that. For the people listening at home. But in terms of the game itself against the USA Friday night, as I said, 8:30 Irish time. I think coming into the tournament, this one was probably being earmarked as the most winnable of the three games. The closer we get to it now, it's shaping up like a really, really, really closely fought match. Like you look at the USA's two fixtures, well beaten by England, which you'd expect most teams to be, 22-14 against France. On paper, it looks like two very, very evenly matched teams.
Absolutely. And like as I said, USA have been a strange one over the last few years in the competitions that they've played in, because it's hard to get a gauge on how their form is. They're kind of hit and miss in the competitions that they've played. But yeah, as you said, on paper, definitely. Obviously, they're coming off the back of the two losses against two tough teams, you know, coming out the gaps and having to play England first is always a tough ask. But yeah, and again, France haven't probably been at their best, but you still saw flashes of what USA can bring. They're the same, similar to Ireland. They have a good influx of kind of sevens players in there and crossover players in there, like Olive Kelter in the centre. She can play fullback as well. So yeah, they're it's definitely there for the taking for the girls. It's just a case of, as you said, there's probably another training session now today. They probably train to get through before they, well, probably, yeah, before they get through on Friday. So yeah, it's a good chance to kind of reset, regroup, as you said, take the learnings from the game that they had, but also like focus on the good bits, because I said there'll be a lot of positives to take from that Canada match, probably more than people would have given the girls credit for, you said, going before going into that competition. So it's nice to have that, those positives to be building upon. So yeah, they'll be very excited for it, but hopefully there'll be a good clean bill of health to pick from in terms of team. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, and like even just looking through the table, there's plenty on the line, which is really, really great. Like it's the way the fixtures have shaped up. England and Canada, first and second, are playing each other in the final round of games. France and New Zealand, who are fourth and fifth behind Ireland, are playing each other. There's a very good possibility that a win for Ireland against the USA on Friday is enough for a third place finish. If they were to win with a bonus point, they could potentially finish as high as second in the tournament, depending on how the results go as well. There's a huge carrot for Ireland to chase here.
Go after it. It's brilliant, isn't it? Like, and as I said, as you said, for us to be able to be sitting here for the 3 weeks and to be able to talk like about a win and a disappointing defeat, but a defeat that's one that has left a lot of opportunities there for the, you know, that the girls had a lot of opportunities just for those unfortunate yellows. But yeah, it's a great position to be in, all to play for going into this weekend. And as you said, like this probably in reality was the game that they would have eyeballed in terms of being the most evenly matched on paper. Obviously, anything can happen on the day, but I have no doubt that the girls will be looking to finish strongly, like the last game of it, that they will want to hit the ground absolutely running when they go against the USA. And they'll be well aware of the strengths that they have, a big pack as well, big dominant scrum, that they're well able to meet them in the forwards department. But yeah, so it should be a really, really good game and a nice civilized hour as well to watch that. So it should put in a good crowd of viewership as well.
Yeah, 8:30 Irish time,
Yeah,
thank God.
no ourselves.
The last bit, like just when you look back to, I suppose, from the Interpros to gathering into camp straight afterwards, the Australia fixture being an extra one on top of it, and these three games with 6 day turnarounds in between rather than seven, like it's been a tough slog for a lot of these players now for probably just upwards of 2 months. I'm assuming though you would have no fear that there's enough in the tank for 80 more minutes to go hell for leather at it.
100%. Like, as you know yourself, like when it's the last game of a campaign like this, it's almost like your body knows that it's coming to the last game and you're like literally everything on the line, especially as you said, there's so much to dangle in front of them and what's on the line in terms of positions, places, what they can achieve with it. And they'll be wanting, the girls will be wanting to go out and show them more than they wanted to back up this weekend. It might have gone to plan. They'll be wanting to show that it wasn't a flash in the pan against the Black Ferns, that it wasn't a fluke, that they can back it up and do it again. So they will be wanting to perform their very best. Finish on a high, definitely. They will see no reason why they cannot beat. If they beat Black Ferns, why not beat USA as well? So they'll be gunning for it. So it should be a really good spectacle. I think I'd like to see them bring back that composure that they had in the first game. I thought they looked a bit, at times, a bit scattered. As you said, the pressure that Canada put on them in the loose and kind of in the wider areas did seem to put them under a bit more pressure. You know, losing that kick battle and kind of uncharacteristically, like, shoveling passes. I won't say the word that we normally say, but shoveling passes in the,
Jackman has said a lot worse down the years, don't worry.
I know, yeah, I won't, I'll try and keep PC. But yeah, like shoveling stuff like that that wasn't there at all with the Black Ferns game. Black Ferns game, very direct, everyone knew what they were doing. It was bang, 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 very much disciplined. Where, and I suppose it was the entity of like the unknown, that Black Ferns didn't know much about us going into it, or probably took it a little bit for granted. And you said Canada did the homework, but yeah, that just kind of disappeared a little bit. The girls, you could see there was a bit of franticness at times and uncharacteristic mistakes, unforced errors, knock-ons or missing touches like that that you wouldn't have seen ordinarily. All teeny tiny little components that kind of layer on to all of a sudden easy ins, easy out, and energy gainers for Canada. So the girls, that's easy fixes. The girls will look at that and they will literally be raring to go. So I've no doubt that we'll see another rejuvenated performance on Friday night.
I don't think I've actually pushed you for a verdict on the previous two games. I'll do it now, though.
Oh
Ireland or
yeah.
USA on Friday night?
For Ireland, USA, well, definitely Ireland. I say Ireland could go and get a bonus point. I'm gonna say that we play with good flair. We finish on a high. I'm gonna throw it out there and say, do you want to get my score? Am I going so much as a score?
You don't have to give it. You don't have to give a score.
I'll
Bonus
say bonus point
a
win.
bonus a bonus point win is a bold enough
Yeah.
prediction, in
Yeah,
fairness.
I'm gonna
And
go for it.
well, look, fingers crossed if you're right. We're going to hope that England do a good job on Canada at the weekend,
I
and
think they
that
will.
might, who knows, that might be enough for Ireland to finish second. But
Yeah.
listen, we won't be greedy. Hannah, thanks a million for joining us as usual on the podcast, and I'm sure we'll speak to you again soon.
Cheers. Thanks a million, Neil.